So continuing with the chapter on Atammayata, this is the last part of it. At the end of the reading yesterday was quoting the Kalakarama Sutta, saying that was of great significance and was used by the elder Maharakita as his main theme when teaching in Europe, bringing the Dhamma teachings to the Greek community, the Yonikas, in that period of time. Around the same time, the first monastery where a Sīma was established in Sri Lanka, close to Mahintale, where the Arahant Mahinda and his companions were reputed to have landed. They came from India by flight. They flew in and landed at Mahintale. And nearby, the first monastery was established where they spent the first rains retreat and where the first Sīma boundary was established, a place called Kaludiya Pakuna, which means the Black Pond Monastery, which is still functioning as a monastery today, amazingly. And the Sīma boundary there is very similar to the original Sīma boundary we had in the garden at Chithurst, about the same kind of dimensions, the edge of the Black Pond. And in the grounds of that monastery, there was a stone Dhamma seat that when I was being given the tour, very happy to be visiting and given the tour of that ancient monastery with Ajahn Vinita, there's this stone Dhamma seat by the edge of the pond at the center of the monastery, where it was said that the Arahant Kala Buddha Rakita also gave teachings on this same sutta. That was his main theme. And I made the mistake of saying, does this get used as a Dhamma seat nowadays? And they kind of gave me a look. No. So the sacred object. But from that same kind of time, and it is said, according to their local legend, their local understanding, that Arahant Kala Buddha Rakita, in the previous lifetime, in the Buddha's lifetime, he had been the Pandit Sachaka, who was an argumentative and difficult person who engaged with the Buddha and argued and tried to confute the Buddha on a number of occasions. Seemingly, he reappeared in a later lifetime and became an Arahant and gave teachings on this same sutta, the Kalakarama Sutta, from that Dhamma seat at Kaludiya Pakuna Monastery in Sri Lanka. You can visit if you're there and go to Sri Lanka.
Indeed, it's a beautiful monastery.
You went there as well?
Yeah, it's very special.
So, to continue. All the various passages quoted so far in this chapter describe the nature of Atammayata and its related qualities. But perhaps the questions remain. How is this best to be realized? And how can this depth of insight be developed? A text that points directly to this issue, and one of the most useful meditation teachings in the entire Pali canon, is to be found in the Madhupindaka Sutta. There, the Venerable Mahakachana says, this is sutta number 18 of the middle-length discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya, also known as the Sweet Morsel or the Honeyball Sutta. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three, the eye, visible forms, and eye consciousness, is sense contact. With sense contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With such conceptual proliferation, papancha, as the source, the heart is beset by mental perceptions and notions characterized by the prolific tendency with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So too, the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. The solution to this cascade of trouble is that, quote, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to. This is the end of the underlying tendencies to lust, aversion, views, doubt, conceit, desire for being, and ignorance. And those are the seven latent tendencies, the seven anusaya. This is the end of resorting to weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here these harmful, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So that's a very abbreviated representation of the sutta, and it's very well worth looking at directly and exploring. As I mentioned before, the book by Bhikkhu Nyanananda, Concept and Reality, is a very thorough exploration, particularly of that sutta. So this is to say that if, with mindfulness and wisdom, the tendency to go out, quote-unquote, into perceptions, thoughts and emotions is restrained, and one just allows seeing to be seeing, hearing to be hearing, etc., The whole Papancha drama does not get launched in the first place. The heart then rests at ease, open and clear. All perceptions conventionally labeled as myself or the world are seen as transparent, if convenient, fictions. When there is insufficient mindfulness and wisdom, the mind goes out, quote unquote, and attaches to its perceptions and moods, the result of which is the experience of me being pressured by life. That expression in the sutta, the heart beset by mental perceptions and notions characterized by the prolific tendency with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye, the Pali for that section is papancha sanya sankhara. And so it's essentially that feeling of me here in relationship to the world and a sense of tension between those two, either pressure, conflict, not getting what you want, being oppressed by what you don't want, being afraid of something that's dangerous or something that we have opinions about. So that sense of a separate me and a separate world and a sense of tension and stress between those two. It's papancha sanya sankhara. It's a very, very long Pali word, but it's a way of understanding that. Both an apparently solid self and a solid world have been unconsciously created, and the friction between the two is the dukkha that we find ourselves running from so regularly and ineffectively. Trying to find a me without a world that burdens it is like trying to run away from our own shadow. No matter how hard we run, the effort is bound to fail, as the one form generates the other. The aim of all these teachings on Atamayata is to show us that the dualities of subject and object, me and the world, and also when we say the world, it also means the inner world of our thoughts and memories, our ideas, our imagination, our plans and opinions, me and the world, do not have to be brought into being at all. And when the heart is restrained from going out and awakens to its fundamental nature, a bright and joyful peace is what remains. This is the peace of Nibbana. These reflections on Atamayata bring us to the end of our exploration of the conditioned realm, and with this we begin the next phase of the inquiry. So before we go on to that, any particular questions or thoughts? There's a lot in these passages, and a lot could be explored. Both Lumpo Basando and I have frequently quoted the Madhupindika Sutta, and your whole extensive teachings can be looked into and expounded upon with respect to papancha, that conceptual proliferation. So a lot could be said about that. It could be proliferated upon. But for now, any particular questions or thoughts come to mind, or anything that would be useful to clarify? Any comments from you, Lumpo, on that?
Well, I'm just, my memory cells are tingling, trying to remember. I think the, within that structure of that sequence of perception and conceiving, and there's, in the verb structure of the Pali, there's a distinct shift from just a pure verb to a subjective verb.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's a me thinking, me proliferating.
That's a very good point, because the first part of it, there was that question a few days ago about the breaking of the dependent origination cycle between contact, passa, and vedana. So when there's that sense contact, and then feeling, and then sanya, it's all still very simple, very uncomplicated. And there's not necessarily any dukkha associated with that. And it's a bit different from the sequence that you have in the classic renditions of dependent origination, because after feeling in the Madhupindika Sutta, it mentions sanya. So sanya, the Pali word sanya, which means perception, is also related to the English word sign. The sense contact is like the kind of neural impact. So the light hits the eye and meets the light-sensitive cells in the retina, then an impulse goes down the optic nerve and then reaches the visual cortex in the brain, and that's affected. So that's the eye consciousness arising in the visual cortex. Then it's up to the visual cortex to say blue or red. Without the words, it registers the form or the color or the visual object. And then, following the sanya, there's the vitaka, which is conceptual thought. That's when the word blue arises, or microphone, The sanya is, with respect to vision, the visual cortex registering the input and then creating its sort of association. So going back to my TIA that happened a month or so ago, it was interesting. It was actually the word conundrum. I was looking at that word, ironically, looking at that word, and I could see the letter C and the O and the N and so on. And I could say, that's a C, that's an O. What sound do they make? There was no vitaka. There was the sanya. I could see the shapes, and I had the forms of them, but there was no way to associate those shapes with a sound or a meaning. Things collapsed between sanya and vitaka in that particular fusing short circuit in my brain, or disconnection, whatever it was. So it was kind of interesting while it was first happening, and I was looking at that, trying to see what those black marks meant, and there was nothing there. It was like black marks on a white background. I could think, but I couldn't get the meaning from the symbols. It was an interesting instance of that process. Yes?
I've heard sanya interpreted as perception / memory. Is memory included in sanya?
It is part of it. Interestingly, the word sati, mostly translated as mindfulness, is also very closely associated with memory. So I don't know if you have...
The root sat is pointing to memory. Because also without memories you can't associate. So sanya is draw those associations dependent on your memory bank and recognition.
It's kind of an interesting approach, but Ajahn Panduwato, in his book, pretty much uses the word memory as his translation of sanya. That direct.
Oh, right. Interesting. Yes?
Are unworldly feelings to be treated the same? Unworldly feelings in that group of perception feelings and sanya, vedana, sanya, sankara. When it comes to unworldly feelings, do they not take a slightly different course? Because some of them appear in the cessation cycle, for example, like joy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, happiness, joy. The pleasant spiritual feeling.
Yeah, it's a good question. Sometimes the unworldly feelings can be more dangerous than the worldly ones. Because because they have that quality of wholesomeness and natural beauty and a spaciousness. In the next chapter, we'd come on to that, the considerations of this is conditioned and thus gross, even up to sort of rupa jhana, arupa jhana, this is conditioned and thus gross. You know, keep remembering that even these very wholesome, beautiful, noble feelings, unworldly feelings, that sustaining that vision or that framework for them, this is also conditioned and gross, so don't be tricked, don't be fooled by that. Whereas the worldly feelings... a bit more kind of highlighted, obviously, like, I hate that person, she's awful, rah. It's like, okay, that's clearly an object not to be grasped or to be identified with. But the unworldly feelings that are associated with wholesome qualities, bright qualities, liberating qualities, they are very comfortable, they're a pleasant abiding, as we're talking about Lumbu Cha's stress on not attaching to happiness or to goodness. It's like that kind of domain. It's tricky territory to create sort of fear or aversion. Oh, this is pleasant, this is really good. Yeah, get away. Kind of, it's not to create aversion or the vibhava tanha or in relationship to those, but that kind of cool, clear recognition. Oh, this is also something that's conditioned. It's an arisen quality. Therefore, be careful and know this as it is in that respect. That was how I would relate to that. Any thoughts on that?
No.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could comment on this. I've noticed this for a long time. When the mind rests in awareness and it's not going out, it feels very, very natural. It knows that this is the place to be. But still, over and over again, no matter how clearly it sees this pure quality and peaceful quality, it still go out to thoughts. Well, going out to external senses is very gross and clear, but even thoughts, I see the mind like It goes out. It keeps going out. It keeps grabbing. It keeps identifying, even though it knows this is dukkha. It's seen over and over and over. And there are moments when it doesn't go out. But still, it continues to do that. And it continues to identify. So I was wondering whether you comment on that.
Well, what comes to mind is to say that not all members of the committee are functioning on the same program.
Okay. Could you elaborate?
So we tend to think of the mind as a single thing. Mm. But personally, I find it's more helpful to consider it as a committee. Mm. Quite a few people use that kind of languaging because you've got a number of different attitudes or motivations that are conditioned in what we call our mind. And they can be quite varied in the conditioning and habits that are associated. So some of the members of the inner committee are completely clear and awake and utterly uninterested in believing in a thought, and others are eager to grab onto anything that's moving just for the sake of something to grab. And, you know, a great variety. I find it's most helpful to be ready to name that process, even if they're like a strong habit that can't just be switched off by, oh, look, you know, my mind is moving towards restlessness or sleepiness or speculation. You know, oh, look, my mind's speculating. Stop that. You can't just decide for it to stop and it stops. But to recognize, oh, here is that member of the committee, that aspect of mind that loves to speculate, that loves to go into thinking or loves to remember and relive memories or loves to plan or in those realms of thinking. That's what this is. This is the planning mind having an interesting day. That's what this is. And no comment, no sort of, it shouldn't be there, or how can I get rid of this, or this is bad and wrong, but just, here it is. And in the practice as I experience it, the simpler that kind of naming and clarification process is, the more effective. Rather than getting into a whole kind of papuncha string of, therefore I should, just, here is the mind getting drawn into speculation. Here's the mind getting into anxiety. That's what this is. Full stop. Just naming what's present with no comment about it. I don't know if you have any particular methodologies, but that's my favorite way of working with.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the expectation of unanimity within the mind for every thought and feeling, perception to be absolutely unanimous and everybody on board, everything on board is kind of idealizing what we think our mind should be. And to me, what is more important is the flavor of disenchantment and recognizing it without proliferating, which is really important, because you can't strategize to get out of that. What you can do is realize this is dukkha, and be willing to get that flavor of disenchantment.
I was wondering about exactly that. It's like the mind has seen how it is on both sides. It is disenchanted to a certain degree, yeah. But not enough.
Yeah. But that's why we keep practicing.
The sense of disenchantment is not strong enough. Is it because the wisdom faculty is not strong enough?
Well, even idealizing that if I only had more wisdom, then I'd be able to crack this nut. Because the bar keeps... That bar is set by our desire. Mm. And so the bar keeps moving because we invest in that desire. Mm. And so that disenchantment is really...
Desire for disenchantment.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The disenchantment is, in a way, you're taking away the enchantment. So that it's still the perceptions are there, but the mind is not making a whole story around it. So if there's something that you like or something that you dislike, say, for example, the mind isn't proliferating around food, that you forget food exists until you're in the line at the mealtime, and then you see something in a dish and you go, ooh, that looks great. And suddenly the eating demon arises. Wah! But then, you know, your body's hungry, and you see and you smell desirable food, and you go, ooh! And so to think it shouldn't be that way is negating just the body's need for nourishment. That's the recognizing, oh, I forgot food existed until 5 minutes ago, and then suddenly, whoomph, wow, I want to eat the whole thing. Just recognizing, oh, look at that. That's an arisen thing. You're removing the enchantment by seeing it as it is. Okay, I hadn't been thinking about food, and there's food in front of me, my body's hungry, and it goes, ooh, interesting. That's it.
It's a natural response, you say.
Or similarly, aversion. It can be that the anagarika in front of you takes the last one of the things that you really like. Torture, death. Yeah, how dare she? And then you didn't even care about that, you know, 2 minutes ago, and then suddenly this person deserves to be tortured and murdered kind of miserably because they took what you wanted, and it didn't even exist a minute before. And then, oh, look at that, suddenly that arises because of these sort of instinctual reactions. That's it. No need to make a story around it. So the feelings of attraction or aversion in something that's pleasant or painful, they can be there, but it's the not making a story around it. What's that, Gompocha? Kenan. It's just that.
Yeah, just that. Just that much.
It's just that much. That's it. It's just, I want to eat the whole thing. So that's it. It's just that much. It's just the feeling. We don't have to make a drama about it. In a way, it's a kind of compassion for your own conditioning, our own birth. That there are these fears and aversions and desires and the habits that come from birth. Yeah. At the mealtime today, the regular Monday group were asking about my TIA experience. And they said, well, what was the cause of it, Ajahn? And I said, birth. And I'm 68 years old, so, you know, stuff happens and stops happening. You know? There's probably a bit more of a specific medical cause. But yeah, we're born. So the body is going to work well some of the time and not well other times. That's it. Doesn't mean you don't take the medicine and do what you need to, but that capacity that we have just to keep life really simple, just it's just that much. That's it. And with that attitude, that disenchantment, we're still seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, but life is a lot more spacious. There's a lot more room in our experiential field. The experience of living is much more roomy, spacious.
Thank you.
Oh, yes.
The naming of proliferation. We can get into this idea that, okay, now that I've named it, it'll stop now. I kind of have this hope that I've found the key that's going to stop it all, and then I'll get frustrated with myself because, oh, it's still going on. Do I have to name it again, or what do I do now?
I thought me naming it was going to stop it, but it hasn't stopped feeling. That's what this is.
Yeah.
So it keeps that sense of stepping back from what's present.
Yeah.
I do a lot of that. Sometimes what you're naming can take a few words, but just that.
And it seems like I'm just mentally backing off all the time.
That's right. Yes. Well, in a way, you're not backing off. It's more not going out.
Yeah.
Because the mind easily gets drawn into the content of fearing something, wanting something, having an opinion about something, resenting something. And just to be able to name it, oh, this is an experience, rather than being in it and being it.
It kind of seems like the observance thing turns into a whole proliferation of its own. And, yeah, that's confusing.
Different practices work for different people, but I find that in my own mind, the way that it works, just to say, oh, this is the, oh my goodness, this one's really going on forever and ever feeling. That's what this is. And even if it's just for, you know, half a second, it's like, oh, it's a thing that the mind is getting lost in. And that which knows it as a thing is not the thing. It's not identified with it. And so just strengthening that quality of perspective, I find very, very helpful. Also, different beings have different conditioning. So often another helpful way of gaining perspective is, how does this feel in the body? It's all very well, the mind being drawn into this. How does this feel in the body? Where is this in the body? This feeling of excitement or irritation or dullness? What does it feel like? Where is it? And this using the somatic, non-verbal, non-conceptual entry point can be very, very helpful.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
It seems there's so many things to comment on. It's kind of overwhelming. How to deal with that?
Well, this is the feeling of overwhelm. If that's what's being experienced, so there's so much going on, it seems overwhelming. Here is there's so much going on, it seems overwhelming feeling. Here it is. Again, that might seem not very helpful, but I was saying to our friend here, okay, if it's overwhelming on the mental level, the body is in a way much more simple. It's non-conceptual, it's not so complicated. How does the body feel in relationship to this overwhelmed feeling or this sense of so much going on? Where is it in the body? How does this feel? You can experiment with that kind of an approach.
I would say there's often so much going on in the body.
No, just breathing in and breathing out.
Life does happen only one moment at a time. Just using a simple reflection like, how does this feel now? What's happening now? This present experience, what is this? How is this? And just keep bringing it back to the present to the extent possible.
Remembering from long ago, the story of Lumpa that you tell about the Roshi who just slap his belly and say, body knows.
Body understands. Yeah. It was actually my first year as a monk. During that period, there was an Australian guy who spent a couple of years in Zen monasteries and Rinzai monasteries in particular. I can't remember the name of the Roshi, but anyway, a very well-known one of his head monks would look after the interviews, the Takusan.
Dokusan.
Especially in Sesshin, you would go once or twice a day to have your interview. It's quite brief. You go in, you bow to the Roshi, you give your answer, and the Roshi will give you some kind of guidance or not. He'll just dismiss you. And he said it was for him. He was working with this koan, trying to figure it out, trying to get a handle on this Dharma problem, the koan practice. And he would go in. He was a big man. Big belly, and he come in every time. He said, bow. And then when the interview was finished, he would immediately ring the bell and there'd be the dismissing. So he'd come in, give his answer, Roshi would ring the bell, laugh and slap his belly, his body understands. And it just drove him nuts, trying to figure it out. But after quite some time, he finally figured out, I'm going to put the mind down and just be with the experience.
Yes.
According to what you read the book, first is contact and then pasa vedana. Yeah? So first when we have contact, there is no self yet. For example, if I contact something like, I feel something painful, that time I feel I have no self. Mm-hmm. And then when I feel painful, it's still no self, but the minute I feel that, oh, I don't like this painfulness, like desire not to have it, it's feeling like more self in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Related with the desire and the self, it's always come together or it's not always.
To some greater or lesser extent, that's it. The Madhupindika Sutta, also the teaching to Bahia, it focuses around that. In the seen, there's only the seen. In the heard, there's only the heard. There's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. In that realm of contact and feeling, then there can be a great deal of mindfulness and clarity, and there's no sense of self that is necessarily arising. It's when the feeling conditions craving, or in the Madhupindika Sutta, where sanya conditions vitaka, the thinking, and then the thinking conditions papancha, then it's a different way of describing that same kind of grasping process. And that's where the I'm thinking, I don't like this, or this is great, I want more of this. This is, I'm hearing, I'm seeing, I'm feeling, I'm thinking, I'm remembering. That gathers around what the mind does with those particular feelings. So in a way, the realm of feeling, Vedana on its own, is quite innocent. It conditions craving and papancha very, very quickly. But a lot of the development of mindfulness and wisdom is based around learning to be with the realm of feeling. So forest tradition life, there's a lot of emphasis on mindfulness of feeling. And the Dutanga practices, they're designed to limit things like food, sleep, physical comfort, shelter, all the kind of instinctual areas of our mind, our conditioning. And so the attention is brought to the realm of feeling and learning how to be mindful of feeling, aware of feeling. In forest tradition life, there's a lot of uncomfortable feeling, more than super pleasant feeling in terms of living conditions. But the ethos of that, the spirit of it, is learning to be at ease with feeling and not letting the feeling condition craving. One of the teachings about the succession of experience that is very, very significant, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of the Tens, I think Sutta number 58, if I remember correctly. And it describes a kind of sequence of experience when there's a grounding in vijja rather than avijja. So it says, rooted in interest are all things, born of attention are all things, arising from contact are all things, diverging into feelings are all things. So there's interest, attention, contact, so up to passa, and it conditions feeling, vedana. Then it says, headed by concentration, dominated by mindfulness, surmounted by wisdom. So samadhi, sati, panya, if that's there in relationship to feeling, then the result of that is that they yield vimutti, deliverance, as their essence, and then merging in the deathless and terminating in nibbana. So that's a different sequence. So if the mind is very awake, very aware, there's still contact and feeling, but with samadhi, sati, and panya, then the result of that feeling, even if it's a painful feeling or pleasant feeling or neutral feeling, the result is vimutti and the liberation, emerging with the deathless. Amatogada is the Pali for merging in the deathless and terminating in nibbana. That's the result of sensory experience. So in a way, it's very, very helpful format to have in mind in meditation, recognizing, oh, that's the way that it works. If there is a strong quality of wakefulness, awareness, heedfulness, then irrespective of whether it's painful feeling, pleasant feeling, neutral feeling, it leads to those liberated, peaceful qualities. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So in that shameless self-promotion, that little book of mine, Catastrophe Apostrophe, then I talk about that sutta, and there's a handy-dandy diagram of an apple tree that is a way of symbolizing that kind of process. Okay, so should we go on to the next chapter? So this is chapter 7, Attending to the Deathless, the Amata Dhamma. This chapter, and those subsequent to it in this section of the book, will describe the practice of turning towards the unconditioned, the deathless, the need to attend to it, and some of the ways that the Buddha talked about its nature. And then we have a quotation from the Book of the Threes, the Anguttara Nikaya. This is a dialogue between Venerable Anuruddha and Venerable Sariputta. So this is just before Anuruddha's enlightenment. Then Venerable Anuruddha went to Venerable Sariputta, where he was staying, and on arrival, greeted him courteously. After an exchange of friendly greetings, he sat down to one side. As he was sitting there, Venerable Anuruddha, he said to Venerable Sariputta, "By means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, I see the thousandfold cosmos. My energy is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unaroused. My mind is concentrated into singleness. And yet, my mind is not released from the outflows through lack of clinging," the release from the asava. So Venerable Sariputta responds, "My friend, when the thought occurs to you By means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, I see the thousandfold cosmos. That is related to your conceit. When the thought occurs to you, my energy is aroused and unsluggish, my mindfulness is established and unshaken, my body is calm and unperturbed, my mind is concentrated into singleness. That is related to your restlessness. When the thought occurs to you, and yet my mind is not released from the outflows through lack of clinging, that is related to your anxiety. It would be good, it would be well if, abandoning these three qualities, not attending to these three qualities, you directed your mind to the deathless element. So, a very blunt advice from his companion in the holy life. Very clear, friendly, brotherly advice. So, after that, Venerable Anuruddha, abandoning those three qualities, not attending to those three qualities, directed his mind to the deathless element, the Amata Dhatu. Dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent and resolute, he in no long time reached and remained in the supreme goal of the holy life, for which people rightly go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for himself in the here and now. He knew. Birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is no more coming into any state of being. And thus, Venerable Anuruddha became another of the Arahants. That's Sutta 128 in the Book of the Threes. There are many such delightful and pithy vignettes in the Pali Canon. The simplicity and directness of the exchange between two companions in the holy life, the apparently affectionate and ironic demolition of the pride and anxiety in relation to achievements that the average spiritual aspirant might be pleased even to approach, and the direct and practical pointing out of the path. All these elements are present in this brief account. Probably the most significant to the theme of this investigation is the process of turning away from even the most exalted domains of the conditioned realm. Venerable Sariputta's unerring acuity of vision has discerned that, even though his friend's meditation has been bringing some spectacular results, Venerable Anuruddha was later to be named by the Buddha as the one most accomplished in seeing into other realms of existence, he has been missing the crucial and liberating element, the presence of the unconditioned. To enable his friend's attention to make this radical shift of view, Venerable Sariputta employs the tactic of naming the ways in which his mind is misapprehending and identifying with these experiences. He also, it seems, is defining the three problems that Venerable Anuruddha is beset with in terms of the final three of the ten fetters, the Sanyojana, the fetters of conceit, asmimana, restlessness, udaccha, and ignorance, avijja. The last of the three might be debatable as a parallel for anxiety. The Pali word in the text here is kukuchasming. However, as Venerable Anuruddha is clearly close to the final realization of arahantship, these three particular elements would necessarily need to be seen and overcome for his heart's liberation to occur. His brother in the holy life is merely pointing out to him that the I, quote-unquote, that keeps appearing in his thoughts about those two achievements and the lack of the third achievement has been obscuring the deathless element and has actually been the stumbling block obstructing the path. So just as I mentioned a couple of days ago, that ignorance causes even the means of transcendence to become an obstacle, so that even though there are these really very wholesome and exalted qualities arising on account of Venerable Anuruddha's meditation, the way the mind is relating to those that I can see into the thousandfold cosmos and so on, the way the mind is relating to those exalted experiences and qualities is unconsciously creating the obstacle to enlightenment, to liberation. Are there any questions, thoughts, any comments from Paul on the quite a frequently quoted dialogue?
No, it's a really important dialogue because it is, just as you mentioned, to emphasize that, because sometimes we think that, you know, if only we got this insight or this meditative experience, then everything would be fine. But it still requires a real discernment and a turning back from the realm of me and mine and experience.
When Jack Cornfield had been a monk with Lungpo Char for a little while and had gone off to go and practice and study with a number of other teachers in Thailand and in Burma, Myanmar, and had quite significant, you know, strong, powerful meditation experiences, when he came back to Wat Bopong, I wasn't there, so I was still in short trousers, I think. When he came back and recounted these experiences to Lungpo Char, and Jack, in his own account, says, you know, he thought, well, I've been doing pretty well here. You know, things have been shaping up. I had some pretty interesting stuff happening. Lungpo Char was profoundly unimpressed, according to the stories, the account that Jack gave, and simply went, just a few more things for you to let go of. And I feel that's extraordinarily kind, compassionate, and helpful teaching, because, you know, if suddenly the mind opens up and you can see into all these different realms of existence, into the different heavenly realms, or different past lives and all kinds of visionary states, or there's unremitting mindfulness and awareness, and suddenly everything is really clear and the mind is very, very bright and energetic, and like, wow, this is all great. That turning to, well, who is it that is assuming they're experiencing? Is there a sense of an owner who has these experiences? Who is the doer, the experiencer, the agent? Is that an I? Is that a me? Is there a self that this belongs to, that is knowing this, that's owning this? What about that? And that subtle shift of view, and then highlighting those qualities of conceit and restlessness. We're talking about udaccha, I think, yesterday. Highlighting those qualities and that way that the mind is framing and is holding even such kind of bright and skillful, wholesome conditions. That's the key piece. It's also very significant that Venerable Anuruddha's enlightenment did indeed come shortly after just changing the view, and that it was a shift of perspective, and that similarly that he was an anagami at the third level of realization, according to the accounts when I had that dialogue. Similarly with Venerable Ananda before the first council. Ananda was an anagami at the time of the Buddha's parinibbana. And running up to the first council, Venerable Mahakasapa, who'd been asked to lead the first council, has said, only arahants can come to the meeting. And Ananda, who had memorized all of the Buddha's teachings, was told, no, you can't come to the meeting unless you're an arahant. So, no pressure, but yeah. So then the story goes, as it's recounted in the Vinaya text, the night before the first council was supposed to begin, Ananda sort of up all night doing sitting and walking meditation, and rather like Venerable Anuruddha, you know, he's really working hard at the practice and doing everything he feels is right, but he sees the sky becoming light and dawn is coming, and he realizes, oh, the day is coming, the sky is lightening, still haven't made the final breakthrough. And then he has the thought, well, I should lie down and take a rest. And it's said that Ananda became the only one to realize arahantship outside of the four postures. He sat down on the bench. After his feet left the ground and before his head hit the pillow, then he realized full and complete enlightenment. So it was just that relaxation of no longer sort of striving in an agitated, in a way it's like when he gave up, it was his efforting, and I've got to get this, otherwise things are not going to go well. That very unconsciously self-centered efforting was what was in the way, and all the ingredients, all the necessary qualities were there for full enlightenment, but that efforting and that me strivingness was getting in the way. And as soon as he said, to put words into Venerable Ananda's mind, it's going to be a long day, I should get a bit of a rest before it all starts, so okay, lie down. And then according to the stories, which I suspect are a bit of a commentarial gloss, that to prove his point that he had indeed realized full and complete enlightenment, he arrived at the meeting floating off the ground, flew into the meeting. Just in case anyone was in doubt that he finished his practice. Maybe he did, maybe he did. If I was there, I don't remember it. But the story goes that he arrived floating on air into the meeting and settled down, and people were confident that he had indeed realized full and complete enlightenment. Any final questions, thoughts, comments on this insight of Venerable Anuruddha? Yes.
When you read about some of the stock phrases about stream entry, I think one of them is something like, oh, and they're independent of the
teaching or something, or but it seems to be, even if they're independent, they can still be helped even at a later, you know, later stage. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Independent of others in the teacher's dispensation, that sense of being able to rely on their own resources or not needing to receive input from outside as a form of guidance, a sense of confidence, of like knowing what the path is. So the second of the 10 fetters is vichikicca, doubt. And it's not just doubt about peppermint or chamomile, you know, coffee or tea, but rather, as I understand it, it's specifically doubt about what is the path and what is not the path. So that quality of independence is like there's that certainty of this is what needs to be done. It hasn't been done yet, but there's the going beyond doubt means knowing, oh, this is the path, this is what needs to be done, this is the central task that is to be followed or to be carried out if this life is to be brought to its fulfillment of its potential, that liberation is to be realized. That phrase, going beyond doubt, I would say is related to that, being independent of others. You know what to do, and you know what needs to be done, but then others can come along and can help you to do it. It's that area of knowing what the path is, but then the skillful means that can be shared from others and giving guidance is very, very significant. Frequently, the Buddha and other arahants, like Venerable Sariputta, giving advice that then helps people who are already very skilled and developed in the practice to make the successions of different breakthroughs and different levels of profundity of realization.
Maybe show some shortcuts or something.
Indeed. So, any comments or thoughts?
I think that's pretty much exactly it. But it is a good question. Independent is also not sort of rejecting any assistance or feeling that one has to sort of be by oneself in order to do it. And think of, of course, this sutta in particular is a really great example of really needing guidance. Another example is not so much needing guidance, but seeking guidance, is the sutta when Sariputta realizes full awakening. It's when he is standing behind the Buddha while he is teaching somebody else, and he is fanning the Buddha, and then it's by listening to the Buddha's teaching is the catalyst for his full awakening.
An example that Lumpo Zometo often talks about, when he was a young bhikkhu, Wabapong, his own contemplations about, well, what would I do if Ajahn Chah disrobed and got married? What would I do if Ajahn Buddhadasa said communism is far more effective as a way of human transformation than Buddhism, and or the Dalai Lama said he's becoming a Christian? Lumpo Sumedho is a very imaginative Dharma practitioner. He'd do these kind of thought experiments. So if the Dalai Lama became a Christian, or Ajahn Buddhadasa said, you know, let's all become communists, what would I do? Lumpo Cha says, I'm disrobing and going to get married. What would I do? And then planting those thoughts in his mind, well, I'd get up in the morning, go bindabad, carry on with the practice, and realize, oh yeah, well, that's good. And just kind of playing with those thoughts in his own mind, what would I do? Well, it's okay, they make those choices, that's their business, but I would get up in the morning and practice meditation, go on bindabad, go on the alms round, carry on my life as a bhikkhu. What else would I do? That, I would say, is a very good example of being independent of others in the dispensation. He knows what the practice is. He realized, this is what I need to do. This is what's meaningful in my life, my experience. Okay, so what other people do, that's up to them. It's their business. Okay, so let's finish there for today.